Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, welcome to the Political Party Daily, episode 5 on Friday the 15th of November. Today's guest is the Conservative candidate for Hitchin and Harpenden, who's been the Conservative MP there for 2 years, Bim Afolami. And already, in just 2 years, I mean, we talk about people like Jess Phillips, who've had so much publicity and so much focus and drive in that time. Bim is one of those people, he's only been an MP for 2 years, already facing re-election, and you can see why. People are talking about him already as a future leader, as a potential future prime minister, because he is a very persuasive talker, is a big thinker, has that knack for being able to bring you in. Regardless of your politics, I think you will find something in this interview where you say, you know, there's something about people who are inherently reasonable that just you could imagine yourself at some point, perhaps. Imagine if he goes on to be leader. I think there are people listening to this that maybe haven't voted Conservative before, wouldn't vote Conservative in this election, would listen to someone like Bim and say, well, maybe. Equally, of course, that means he would alienate other people. So that's the nature of politics. But there you go. He was a brilliant guest. Please enjoy Bim Afolami. I'm delighted today to be joined by the Conservative candidate for Hitchin and Harpenden, Bim Afolami. Bim, you've been the Conservative MP for Hitchin and Harpenden for just 2 years. Did you expect to be facing re-election so soon?
No. elections are exhausting. But I do find sort of politician complaining about elections is a bit like, you know, being in the army complaining about guns or being a police officer complaining about sirens. I mean, it's sort of part of the job description, so...
It does go with the job description. The seat itself, Peter Lilly's old seat, always returned healthy Conservative majorities. Yours at the last election was 12,000. But there was a 12-point Labour surge in Hitchin last time.
Thanks for reminding me.
Well, it's more for the context of this election. I mean, do you think Labour have peaked where you are, or can that still go some way? Are you looking over your shoulder a bit?
The answer is it's a very funny political time. So anything can happen. Last time, what you saw, not just in my seat, but across the whole southeast, was a Labour Party that Conservatives had rather complacently assumed that, you know, middle-class people with jobs and houses would never vote for this communist Corbyn. I mean, they could never do that. And frankly, if in places like in my constituency, Labour getting 31-32%, which was their best result since 1997, not just in my seat, but across the whole southeast, they got those sort of results. It tells you that a lot of those people who Conservatives had previously assumed could never vote Labour obviously did. So you can't take anything for granted at all.
You know what's fascinating is yesterday we spoke to Gloria De Piero, who is almost the mirror image. So she holds a Labour seat where the Conservatives have started to do well, still held it last time, although by a far more narrow margin than 12,000. It was just a couple of hundred. But those places where people say, well, people around here are never going to start voting Conservative, and then they do. It feels as if, though, the Tory party is reaching into Labour heartlands, and Labour, to some extent, is reaching into Tory heartlands.
That's true, in particular, in the southeast of England. Because, in effect, you had, in my judgment, a lot of people who, as London has become more distinct politically, people who leave London and move to the home counties, which is a flow of tens of thousands of people every single year, to some degree take their London politics with them as they move. Now, of course, the person who moves is often different to the person who stays. So it's not too different. But it is, you are starting to see people in constituencies like mine who, in effect, have the views that you'd more likely see to be expressed in North London, for example. So my constituency being north of London, Hertfordshire, a lot of people move from North London to it. And so it's very important for the Conservative Party to do well in London, because if the Conservative Party loses London or is on sort of a downward spiral in London, then your downward spiral sort of kicks into other parts of the country. So London, and partly because of the media is based in London, so much of our national conversation starts in London. It really matters, the Conservative Party doing well. So it can, and that's partly a relationship with ethnic minorities, social issues, the way the party's viewed in branding terms, just as much as policy. And I think it's important that we do better in London.
So when you talk about those London values, how would you summarise them? And how are they different to, say, traditional home counties' values?
Well, I think that London, especially, I'm 33 and I know lots of people around my age who live in London, who didn't necessarily grow up there. They grew up in Surrey or Hertfordshire or Berkshire or Hampshire or whatever. I think that London has an open, internationalist view of the world, broadly speaking. It is also multicultural, multi-ethnic. And large parts of the home counties, though they've changed over time, are less like that. So when, and this is a values question, it's not so much, I'm not talking about identity politics, I'm talking about the values people hold. What I think we're starting to find is that what used to be something that was just in London will soon become London and its suburbs, and that will create political differences in those suburbs. But also, on the flip side, when you go to a seat like Gloria Del Piero's in Ashfield or Bishop Auckland or somewhere, these sort of marginal Labour seats in traditional Labour heartlands, or Don Valley or somewhere like this, it means that a lot of those voters can feel more alienated from large parts of the country than in the past, because that sense of how London is different,
yes,
has become bigger and bigger. So it's a weird paradox between the two.
Yes, and as someone who grew up in Nottingham but now lives in London, I remember, you know, during my political awakening, if you can call that, been immensely frustrated at how much of the conversation was about London. I mean, I obviously understood why, it's where power lies and all the rest of it. I didn't have any resentment against the city. But to the rest of the country, the political conversation can feel very London-centric. Would you describe yourself as a One Nation Conservative?
Yes, part of the One Nation group.
Part of the One Nation group. That's where we first met during
during the hustings.
During the hustings, yeah. The last Tory leadership contest. What is the One Nation answer to bringing the UK together? How do you appeal to people in, say, Ashfield as a Conservative and Hitchin and London?
Well, that is the...
I realise that's a big question, by the way.
Well, that's the key question. In my sense, I think there are two aspects to it. There is a national devolutionary aspect, so Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, bit. And then you have a regions and English aspect to that. Because, of course, what you're seeing is parts of, and Brexit, I don't think, has caused a lot of these things, but I just think it's proved to be a stressor or an accelerant. Parts of the United Kingdom, parts of Scotland, or Scotland as a whole, you might argue, parts of Northern Irish society, parts of Wales in a different way, start to question how the union works together. And I would like to see in the manifesto and going forward, if we win a majority, I'd like to see us really try and grapple with the constitutional question in relation to the devolution more broadly, because if we don't and just close our eyes and hope it'll be fine, we could be facing a SNP rout in 2021 in their elections, SNP demanding second referendum, Westminster saying no. You could just get yourself to a position. So I think that it's very, very important that we try and deal with this and bind the peoples of this union more closely together from that respect. But in relation to England, so there's that one bit, but in relation to England, this is the most challenging thing, because when Tony Blair sort of embarked on the devolution experiment, they left out England.
Yeah.
And they left out England, and John Prescott tried with sort of regional assemblies and things, but it didn't quite come off.
Northeast was rejected.
Yeah, it didn't quite come off. But we are going to have more devolution within England and do that in a systematic and serious way with real power. So many, since George Osborne, we've been talking about the Northern Powerhouse. That isn't just a slogan. It's about a region of the country that does have a slightly distinct set of needs, distinct set of views, wants to move forward on certain things in different ways. They've got to have the power to do so. That's the same for the West Midlands. London already has that to a certain degree. But in my judgment, we have to do that in quite a systematic way. The typical British way of doing it is muddling through and sort of, well, we'll give them a mayor with these sorts of powers. We'll give them a sort of big combined authority with these sorts of powers. And actually, I think it's very confusing. I'd like a more comprehensive look at it. Because if we can do that, if we can bring the country back together in that sense and bind the peoples of the country back together, not so much the politicians, but the people, then I think our union will be secure. I think things are perilous enough in the union for us to really address this issue now. I don't think we can just sort of let it rumble.
And as a One Nation Conservative, are you satisfied with the direction of the party with the current leadership?
Yes, I am, because I think that Brexit... One of the things that irritates me a lot about the Brexit debate is some people use the words left and right. Mm. And actually... You know, there are very left-wing people, I don't know, like Jeremy Corbyn, who are pro-Brexit. And they're very right-wing people, you might call Michael Heseltine, who is very anti-Brexit. You know, Brexit is something that cuts across what you might call the typical left and right wing.
Yeah.
If you actually look at what this government's done, whether it be, you know, NHS, investment, and my dad's a doctor, and I take a real sort of keen interest in that, investment in schools, you know, police officers, etc., If we didn't have Brexit as part of this conversation and you just said to somebody, right, so the Tory party is doing a massive investment in the NHS, schools and police. Do you think this is a right-wing thing to do? I think the answer would be no. They'd probably say, well, you know, it's a reasonably centrist thing to do. Probably, dare I say it, even a centre-left thing to do in relation to approach to a public services. That wasn't the approach that David Cameron and George Osborne took, for example. They had a different... more what you might call almost a more orthodox Thatcherite view of the world, whereas the current Prime Minister and a lot of people around him, though portrayed as sort of arch-Thatcherites, in a weird way, in economic policy and domestic policy, are to the left of Osborne and Cameron, who they succeeded, and Theresa May, though Theresa May sort of, she didn't really have long enough to get all that done. So I think that the direction is different, but I wouldn't say it's necessarily left or, you know, left-wing or right-wing. It's different. The job of the Conservative Party now is to, if we get a majority, is to deliver on Brexit, but do it in a way that can embrace the great things about that liberal internationalist part of our culture, as I say, exemplified by London, but not just found in London, at the same time as saying, for those people who voted for Brexit because they believe we want control over borders or laws or certain other things, making sure that they're part of that as well. And if the Conservative Party can do that, that will be a one-nation Brexit. Of course, the flip side is if we don't do it, and the way we do it is portrayed as somehow backward-looking and knuckle-dragging, then of course we'll suffer politically for it. And it's people like me and, you know, more senior colleagues as well, is to make sure that we steer the way we deliver Brexit in the right way. And I'll give you one small example. Some people have said to me, knocking on doors, they still say, gosh, you know, I'm not sure about being able to travel to Europe after Brexit. And I said, well, of course we'll be able to travel to Europe after Brexit. But
it would just cost you more.
No, but what I mean is these things are not things that are going to be politically contentious between the European Union and the UK. People being able to travel or study. But unless we can really make that case and say, look, it's a good thing that you can travel in Europe and we're going to make it easier for you. Your Erasmus schemes are going to still happen. And all of those things, they're the sorts of things that may not seem like massive political issues in Whitehall, but really matter to people. And if we can make sure that people can see that those things are going to be protected and continue and even enhanced in some ways, then I think you do have a chance of making sure that Brexit does bring people together in that sense.
But isn't the problem that this is being led by a guy in Boris Johnson, who is basically trying to have his cake and eat it? You know, he played a leading role in a campaign that raised fears about millions of Turkish people coming to the UK, that made ludicrous claims about how much money we send to the EU instead of funding our NHS. And now he's saying, well, I want to deliver a liberal Brexit. I mean, he wasn't talking about a liberal Brexit during the referendum.
No, I don't think that's fair. I mean, everybody who's watched or seen what the Prime Minister has done in his sort of years of public life when he was Mayor of London or when he was a MP before he became Mayor of London will know that he regards himself definitely as being a very, very, very liberal Conservative. I think I heard a story that at Cabinet, he said to the other cabinet minister, you know, this is the most liberal conservative cabinet we've ever had or for a very long time. And so that is definitely how he sees himself. I definitely think you're right that some people definitely don't see him that way. But part of politics is, well, a key part of politics, and it's something I've tried to do every day, is you have the essential self. And what you're trying to do is to allow people to see enough of that self that it's really who you are. And that's what politics is really about. It's how can I show people what I really am, and that thing that I really am is helpful to them, whether it be as an ambassador for their community, delivering on their priorities, et cetera, et cetera. That is the mother's milk of politics. It's that. I'm sure that's what, you know, he'll be able to do in time. And I've seen in my constituency a lot of people say, look, I wasn't sure about Boris when he became, you know, party leader and prime minister, but, you know, I have to admit that since then he's done a better job than I thought. And so if he can continue doing that, then I think he can continue making inroads. I mean, Boris, this one thing, when you look at the polling on favourability, and all because of politics being in a real funk, sort of everybody's unpopular to some degree.
Yes.
But his popularity has grown since he took office. Now, that's quite rare. Normally what happens, especially for somebody who's quite well known, is that their time in office, in effect, sees them gradually slide down. Boris Johnson has gone the other way. And I think it's because a lot of people thought he was X, and actually they realised he's Y or X plus something or X minus something. So I think there's still room to grow.
Just in terms of yourself then, when you talk about, you know, taking the essential self and then funnelling that through politics, how do you do it?
Well, I try. It's hard. I find it hard at campaign time. I find it much easier when you're not campaigning, because there is essentially an awkwardness when you've been an MP for 2.5 years and you campaign. Because what I really want to say to everybody is, I've been doing this job. You've seen the way I've done the job. And if you like the way I've done it, allow me to continue doing it. But it's hard to really say that. So what you end up having to do is you're knocking on hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands by the end of the campaign, of doors. And you're saying, well, you know, I've done this and I'm going to do this, or I've done that and I'm going to do this. And it ends up being to some degree a transaction at that point. You are, in effect, asking for something and you're hoping they will give you a particular thing. And I find that uncomfortable. It's weird. It's difficult. What I much prefer is when I'm actually doing the job, because then your motives are clearer for people. You can really interact with people without them feeling there's an agenda or something. And I find that is so much easier. So I find campaigning, and I enjoy it, but I do find it difficult because you're sort of permanently in this state of selling yourself, which is difficult to do, as anybody who's ever sold door to door, who's listening.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
For this, will know.
Obviously, a lot of people listening will have done. A lot of people listen to this, do a lot of canvassing themselves for all sorts of parties.
They sound like a fun bunch.
They are across the UK. But most of the listeners, I would hazard, probably have never knocked on a door, so don't know. I mean, I think to most people, the thought of it is horrifying, just knocking on a door, not knowing what you're going to find behind it. And not only that, saying, I'm from the Conservative Party or any party, and will you vote for us, let alone if you're the candidate. I mean, I know when I used to knock doors to the Labour Party, actually you get used to it pretty quick, but I've never been a candidate. So I think that is a distinct thing. I mean, it must feel a little bit dirty. Maybe in time you'll get, you know, when you're running for election again in your 10th election, when you've just stepped down as Prime Minister, you'll find it a bit easier.
I think it's In a strange way, when you're the candidate, it's easier because you have the answers, or you should do. You know, so Luton Airport expansion, which I'm against in my constituency, lots of people don't like it, right? Because we're next door and there's flight, you know, there's aircraft noise and pollution and various other things. If it's one of my team who knocks on a door, and this happened yesterday, they say BIM's against Luton Airport expansion. And they say, but what's he said in response to the Civil Aviation Authority's consultation? Not quite sure. Will you vote Conservative? You know. And that's actually harder, strangely. When you're the actual candidate, at least you can deal with everything.
Yes.
But I do think this happened to me a couple of days ago, where I was knocking on a door in Harpenden, and this lady, I knocked on her door and she recognised me. And she said, gosh, it's so nice to see you. Yes, you know, we vote Conservative in this house. At that point, she said, gosh, I'm really, really sorry, but I've got some ladies coming to see me. Can you just stand there? And she sort of ushered me into her house. I thought, this is a bit weird. And it so transpired that she sells candles and she runs this business selling candles. And these ladies were coming to help her do some sort of Instagram video. And so then she got me to be in her Instagram video selling candy. You know, I hope it didn't look like a sort of hostage video or something. But when I was doing it, and I found myself in her living room with all the cameras and stuff set up, going, hi, I'm Bim Afalami. I think these candles are fantastic. And by the way, they are. But it was... But that sort of quite surreal thing happens to you when you're knocking on doors. And that sort of 15 minutes of my life that will probably never ever, that sort of thing will never ever come again. And that there's an essential kindness to people which overrides the few people who are sort of quite mean. Because, and it's so important you remember the kindness and you remember the positive. Because when you're having to knock on every single door, you've got to do that with an open heart. Or what a lawyer might describe as, you know, clean hands. You do that completely opening yourself to people. And the vast majority of people are really nice and actually very kind. And on the doorstep, you have these weird interactions which make that slightly awkward process of knocking on someone's door and saying, please vote for me and I'm selling you some stuff, a bit more bearable.
See, my fear for you, maybe I think too politically about these things, is that you're going to endorse this lady's candles and then another candle maker in your constituency is going to go, he started campaigning for my rival, he put me out of business, and their candles aren't even that good. The wick doesn't burn to the bottom.
Yeah, exactly. And I probably shouldn't mention the candles for that very reason. But it is, that does actually happen. I find that with pubs. So I got asked, I was doing something for a magazine in Hitchin. They said, what's your favourite pub? And I said, it's the Hermitage pub in Hitchin, which is a very good pub. And this was in my first 6 months, so I naively thought that this was okay.
Yeah.
And then you've got various people say to me, gosh, well, you know, you obviously don't know many pubs in Hitchin, do you? What about that pub? That's a really good pub.
God,
no one goes there. It's a Hermitage pub. That's, you know, that's for these sorts of people. Well, the real people go to this other pub. You think, what? I was just saying it was a good pub. So that definitely happens, especially in a constituency which is, you know, it's about a third Harpenden, a third Hitchin, and a third villages. And most of our villages have village pubs still. You know, we're quite a special area in that sense because, you know, we all know nationally lots of pubs are shutting down for all the reasons we know. But in my constituency, we've managed to hold on to a large number of them. So people are very proprietorial about their pubs.
You mentioned climate change earlier in relation to the Luton Airport proposed expansion. You've been on the Climate Change Committee. Mm. It's something that's very close to your heart. Mm. I mean, Extinction Rebellion have kind of forced it up the agenda as well as, you know, wider campaigns. In terms of this election, if it was going to be fought on green issues, is it fair to say that Labour have a more radical agenda than the Conservatives?
Yeah, they have a more radical one, but it's not realistic because they're just saying things that they must know they can't do. So we've set a target of net zero by 2050, right? Now, 2050 may seem like far away, but it's just over 30 years. Most of the people listening to this will still be around at the time that target...
And still listening to this podcast,
and still listening to this podcast. And when that target comes into force. So it's only 30 years. And
in fact, if you could come back on in 2050 and we can hold you to account.
Yeah, exactly. I will, I promise. And that 2050, just to give you a sense, is six parliamentary terms. It's really not that many.
Well, if they all last, I mean, six parliamentary terms could be 6 years.
I suppose the reason why I say this is in relation to Labour's promise. They've said net zero by 2030. Now, this is just completely unrealistic. The Committee on Climate Change, sort of experts who are non-political and studiously so, who have reported very, you know, and I held a climate change conference in Harpenden with, and I had as the chair, as a neutral chair, because I thought that was very important, Baroness Brown of Cambridge, who's the deputy chair of the Committee on Climate Change. And she made the point at this conference, and she's made it to me privately as well, that 2050 is a really hard target to reach. It's not easy. And it requires big changes. It will require major changes for the way the country works. It will require lots of innovations, lots of technology, lots of tax changes. And so Labour saying we're going to do it by 2030 is really trying to treat people as foolish, because in order to achieve it by 2030, A, it's just not possible without shutting down the economy. And if you were to shut down the economy, then you definitely wouldn't achieve it because you wouldn't have the money for the innovation, etc. But even if it were to be possible, the changes that people would have to make and that our industry collectively, you're going to have to be a lot more honest about what you've been asking people to do. And they're not going to do that. And so from my judgment, yes, it is more radical. But at the essence of being conservative is, yes, you can propose big changes, but you are going to have to show how you're going to pay for them, how you're actually going to make it work, and how you're going to do this in a way that people accept and have consent for it.
Within the party, do you think people like you are winning the argument on climate change?
I mean,
culturally, do you think the Conservative Party, its membership, its core, accepts the need for... I mean, even by 2050, it would be quite radical, actually, to get that down. Do you think the majority of Conservative members are on board?
So if you'd asked me 18 months ago, 2 years ago, I'd have been doubtful as to the answer is yes. But one of the biggest, frankly, really pleasant surprises I've had in politics, there haven't been that many pleasant surprises over the last 2.5 years, most have been pretty awful. But at Conservative Party conference, I spoke on a couple of panels on climate change. I looked out in the audience. The number of people who got up, who talked, they were in their 60s, 70s, saying this is a really important issue. There were councillors, council leaders, activists. They, the older generation, feels this issue just as keenly as younger generations do. And what the younger generation has done, however, is often they've been teaching the elders. So the number of people that have said to me, gosh, you know, I never really thought about climate change, but then my daughter or my grandson explained this to me. And now we're doing this differently. It's really interesting. And I think it's... And the reason for that is, at the essence of conservatives is that sense of needing to conserve, to look after things. That's why the conservatives are very attached to the green belt, because it means that we're looking after something that when it's gone, it's gone. You know, once you build over a green field, it's never going to be a green field anymore. And climate change and dealing with that very much plays into that part of conservatism. So I've noticed, and this is one of the reasons why I push it so hard, is because I know that for a lot of conservatives, they say, gosh, I'm so glad the Conservative Party is talking about this. I never thought the Conservative Party would talk about it. And it's great that they are. And I also know politically that there is no downside for it, because this is something that is definitely going to have to be dealt with. So we either become realistic about that now or in 5 years or 10 years, but you know you're on the right side of history, in which case you really push hard.
In terms of going into a grueling election campaign, your second campaign in 2 years, how do you look after yourself? Do you have a regime? I mean, you're a talented footballer. You played on the university side. Do you still play a lot of sport?
I don't play very much sport. I'd love to say that I sort of play a game a week or anything. I really don't. I wish I did. I think I've become a bit lazy, because I'm lucky enough that I haven't sort of started putting on weight yet.
Because you're young, that's
but when why. But I'm sure at the moment when that happens, I'll be sort of panicking myself to the nearest football pitch. I mean, I do play a couple of games of cricket every summer, and I do that. And whenever I'm got a weekend or something, I'll try and go on a run near my house or something. But I wouldn't pretend. My wife's listening to this probably and laughing. The idea that I'm going on all these regular runs. You know, the one run I did last month doesn't count. But I am... The thing that you mentioned, Matt, that people don't... Most people listening to this have never gone canvassing, right? Anybody who's listening to this who's been canvassing will know how knackering it is.
Yes, it is, yeah.
To be on your feet all day, and especially when it's cold, and you cover a hell of a lot of ground. You know, I looked at my... You know, on the iPhone, that health thing, it tells you how many steps.
Yes, the little heart, yes.
Yeah, the steps you've done. I did sort of 18,000 yesterday.
Wow.
You just walk and walk and walk. And it also, my constituency, because often the houses are quite far apart. And you just walk and walk and walk and walk. I mean, it is quite, you do get fit doing this.
And it's a good app for a politician, isn't it? You know, you can feel like you've delivered 18,000 steps a day under this government, Mr. Speaker.
Yeah, exactly. And now with a different speaker, who's probably, you know.
All right, Lindsay Hoyle, 18,000 steps a day. Sort of vague impression of Lindsay Hoyle, for those of you
who... I wouldn't dare do an impression of
the incoming speaker. But were you a good footballer? You must have been half decent to get in the university.
I was all right. I played played a lot at school and played a bit at university.
And so who would you have modelled yourself on as a player?
Well, I used to regard myself, and I say this very deliberately, because again, I can hear all my former teammates just absolutely about to wet themselves. But I used to regard myself as more... I played sweeper.
Oh, wow, so very creative.
Very old-fashioned position. I was sort of
Chris Waddle.
Chris Waddle or Ruud Gullit. Lothar Matthäus.
Oh,
these are the players I used to admire, and I used to model myself on. And and then my dad told me a lot about how Beckenbauer used to be known as the Kaiser.
Yeah.
And I'd have loved to have been known as the Kaiser. I wasn't, but that was the sort of that would have been the end point. But no, I was very lazy, but I was good at reading the game, so I could always work out where things were going to happen. And of course, in football, that's most of what you're trying to do, especially if you're playing sweeper. You've got to try and know where the ball's going, and that's how you stop them getting there, because you're not marking. Such a fun position. But these days, very few people play with it. Most teams play 4-3-3, so you know, most of the younger guys or girls listening to this won't even know the position of sweeper, I suspect.
Well, it's... It only lasted for a sort of period of time, didn't it? And it was always seen as quite a continental thing, as a sort of quite an exotic luxury.
Yeah.
Well, it never really got used in English football.
No, not really. We used to play 3-5-2, and
crowd the midfield.
Yeah, exactly. 3-5-2, but again, you can only play 3-5-2 when you've got people who can play wing back.
Yeah.
And it's such a tough
bombing
position.
On.
Yeah, very very tough to play wing back. And also, as I say, I was lazy, and it meant that I didn't have to mark when you play sweeper, which suited me down to the ground. I used to be able to play, you know, the pass I wanted to be able to play in my own time, at the back. Never had to mark, so rarely were things my fault.
Can we extrapolate your political identity from that, do you think?
Lazy.
Lazy, nothing's your fault.
Well, no. No, I'm terribly hardworking and everything's my fault. No, it is... I think, actually, it was weird. I was speaking to my mother about this. It's part of what politics is about, not so much campaigning, but sort of day-to-day politics in Westminster, is working out what you want to do, what you want to talk about, what you want your things to be. Because that's much harder than it seems. So I remember when I first started, and the senior colleagues who give you advice, they say, specialise in one or two things. But you sort of think, well, I don't really know. Does that mean one or two things locally? Does that mean one or two things nationally? How do you get a national voice on the economy as a new backbench MP? I mean, how's that going to work? It's really hard. And actually, within the last couple of years, I've sort of found my way. But it is harder than people think to get that. What are the things you're going to do? And not ignore other things, but try and build a voice on those particular issues. And that is what politics is really about. A bit like things in life, really, or any profession.
Just finally, I know this is so hard, and I know predicting politics is almost pointless given the events of the last few years. Mm. But if forced to predict the outcome of this election, and it can be vague, you can say a Conservative majority, or you can put a number of seats on it, you could say hung parliament, such and such the largest party. If forced to predict, if you had to put a fiver on it, what would you say the outcome would be?
I'd say a Conservative majority for the following reason. There is such a distrust and dislike of Jeremy Corbyn and a fear in the country that a Corbyn government, I'm not talking about going back to the 70s and all that stuff, but just a Corbyn government would bring us back on the EU, we'd have to do a referendum on that, you'd end up having one in Scotland. Just the sense that with Corbyn would be going backwards rather than moving on forwards and getting on with it. I think that is going to be one of the biggest factors driving a Conservative majority.
Bim, thank you so much for coming in. It's been an absolute treat.
Thank you.
Well, there you go. Bim Afolami, who predicts a Conservative majority. That goes on the political party prediction Charty. And so far, only Gloria De Piero on there predicting that Labour would be the largest party. But let's see. And it is, to borrow a phrase, just a bit of fun. Don't forget, you can email your stories of canvassing and campaigning woe to politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. Given the subject matter of yesterday's, I was going to call this section Electoral Dysfunction because it works for yesterday's story and I think just in general. So this is from a Conservative canvasser. The very first time I ever went canvassing, proudly sporting a blue rosette and with my back Boris Oyster card holder in my pocket, was for Boris Johnson's mayoral campaign in West London in 2008. Within 10 minutes, a pissed up elderly Scottish gentleman had come right up close to me on Sutherland Avenue and bellowed, "Way the fuck you voting for that gun? I've not worn a rosette since. Where is this sage soothsayer now? All the best, Nicky." Well, Nicky, I'm very sorry that you had such a blunt experience. I'm sure it was nothing personal. I mean, often with these things, they can be about what that individual is going through at that particular time. I mean, who knows? Maybe he's voting for Boris at this election. Let's put him down as a maybe. So don't forget, email your stories into politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. It doesn't have to have happened to you. It could be something you've heard on the grapevine through your local party. I'll see you Monday.